We are starting into Romans chapter 13 this morning. And for the benefit of those who are visiting today, I just thought I'd point out that in our preaching ministry here, we follow what is known as the expository method, the expository approach. In general, what that means is that the point of the message being preached is the point of the passage, as opposed to some other point that the preacher might want to say, or as opposed to a point from some other passage. We try to focus on specifically what it is that each particular passage is in the Bible to contribute to us as God's revelation. And more specifically, it means that for the most part, we are just working chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph, through whole books of the Bible. Because God's Word was given to us, not as isolated verses here and there, but it's been given to us as literary units that hang together, we strive to look carefully at how each letter, how each narrative book, how each psalm, whatever the case might be, how it is all put together and how every portion contributes to the unfolding revelation of God and to the message of the particular book that we're looking at. And it's important to keep that goal in mind as we come to a passage like Romans 13. If you have a Bible with headings, maybe it says something like mine does. For chapter 13, the first half anyway, it says submission to the authorities. And specifically, it's talking about the authorities that God has placed over us in civil government. I feel a little bit bad in the sense that we've had all of this rich music that speaks to us about Christ and his work in our lives as shepherd and the one that we run to and the trials of life and the one who died for our sins and the one who cares for us so tenderly. And the message is about the government. You probably are thinking, I think enough about the government, I hear enough about the government during the week. I don't want to come to church and think about that here too. Well, I sort of feel the same way, and yet this is the Word of God. And one of the benefits of an expository approach is it focuses to think beyond ourselves, maybe, if that is necessary, beyond our immediate needs and problems, beyond our sort of often self-oriented concerns, and strive to think God's thoughts about whatever it is he has chosen to reveal in his Word. And actually, his Word says a lot about this subject, and it is actually a part of life that is inescapable and a part of life that we need God's instruction about, that we need our thinking shaped by his Word about. A couple of weeks ago, I saw one of these memes online, and it was a picture of a lady that had been pulled over by a policeman for speeding. And the text was her response, and she said something like, "It's okay, officer. I'm not under law. I'm under grace." When you read some of the statements of Paul in Romans, you might be tempted to come to a conclusion like that about the government or about whatever area of life. You read all these glorious truths about the fact that we are righteous in Christ, that nothing can threaten that position, that we are totally secure in Him. And it would be very natural to conclude that therefore our sin and our obedience, they really don't matter that much, because after all, Christ has performed for us. He has obeyed the law of God in our place. He has taken our punishment upon himself. So why is it that important that we should be concerned about submitting to laws, especially human laws? Especially when we're not talking about verses of the Bible necessarily that tell us the will of God, but these are policies and other issues that have been established by human authorities, most of which don't know Christ anyway. Why would it be important as Christian people to be concerned about that? Well, the Apostle Paul had already addressed some of this in principle back in chapter 6 when he brought up that natural way of thinking and the idea that if we have been saved by grace, then let us sin that grace may abound. And he says, may it never be. That would be a horrible perversion, a horrible twisting of the gospel. And he goes on to speak about submission a lot in that passage. He talks about us being submitted to the form of doctrine that we have received. He talks about our responsibility to present our members as instruments of righteousness to God and putting ourselves at his disposal for the purposes of obedience to him. And when it comes to chapter 13 and the point of this passage, we're looking at one dimension of that. We're looking at our responsibility to be subjected to civil government. If you look at verse 1, the very first part, it just right off the bat gives you the thesis of the whole paragraph when it says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Subjection to civil government. That is the thesis of this portion of the Bible, and that is our theme this morning. In fact, we're going to have two messages on that today, and Lord willing, next Lord's Day. And it's very helpful to get a big picture of this passage, to know how it all hangs together, to know its outline. Let me try to lay that out for you. Paul does give you the thesis at the beginning of verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, and he expects maybe that our answer, our response to that is going to be, why? Why does this matter? Why should I do this? Notice that the next line begins with the word for. And so he's going to give you reasons. In fact, this passage is going to give you two primary reasons. And the first one starts in the middle of verse 1 and goes to the middle of verse 2. He says, here's one reason. Because there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And the first motivation for submitting to civil government is that that government has been appointed in that position by a sovereign God. Now, if that is true, then you would expect that God would end up meting out certain consequences to those who disobey him by disobeying the government. And actually, that is how verse 2 ends, that those who resist will incur judgment. That's probably not talking about eternal judgment, the final penalty for sin. The rest of the passage indicates that Paul is thinking about the temporal consequences of our disobedience and the kind of penalties on earth that we would very naturally expect for those who resist the established authority. So that's the second reason. The first reason was that civil government is appointed by God. The second reason is that disobedience to civil government brings punishment. And so let's read on. Verse 3 elaborates, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Pretty strong statements about how God views the role of civil government, the responsibility that he has placed on them, whether or not they carry it out consistently or perfectly. Nevertheless, he says he does use them to mete out appropriate consequences for disobedience. And that is the second reason for submitting ourselves to them. In verse 5, what Paul does is to summarize all of that. He's going to restate his thesis, and he's going to restate his reasons, only the reasons are going to be in the opposite order of what I just went through. Let me read verse 5. Here is the thesis once again. Therefore, one must be in subjection. Why? Well, not only to avoid God's wrath. There's that emphasis on punishment. The wrath of God in the sense of the consequences of disobedience. So you obey not only to avoid that, but because of the first reason, that's what he is alluding to when he says, also for the sake of conscience. And he is there revisiting the idea that God is over all of this, and that your conscience ought to tell you that to disobey divinely instituted authorities is to disobey God. And in order to maintain a clear conscience before God, since he is the one who put them there, you submit. You see how he is summarizing his point and how he is revisiting those motivations in opposite order. And then there's two verses left, which are further application as to some of these specific things that we are required to do under government. Verse 6. For because of this, you also pay taxes. And today is April 19th, and we did that or should have done that by the 15th a few days ago. For the authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Notice how he keeps emphasizing, even when it comes to something like taxes, you need to have in mind that they are there actually representing or serving God. And he continues to talk about taxes when in verse 7 he says, pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue, different kind of tax to whom revenue is owed. And then the application kind of broadens out, not so much as far as what you do, but your attitude in giving even your taxes. With reference to these authorities, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. Pretty clear and pretty strong instruction that in many ways goes counter to our natural attitude and certainly to the spirit of this age. And in those seven verses, there is a great deal that is taught explicitly and that is underlying the teaching in terms of what is said and in terms of related questions that come to our minds about civil government and how to integrate this with other passages of the Bible and how to develop an overall worldview regarding the role of civil government. So we are going to need at least two Sundays to deal with this adequately. And in today's time, really, I just want to answer two questions. And basically, the message today is the introduction to the message for next week. Two questions I'd like to address based on what we have read there. Number one, if the thesis of all of this is to be subjected to civil government, what does that mean? And what does that look like? What does it mean to be subjected to these authorities? It is very helpful in answering that question to connect three terms that the Apostle Paul uses right in sequence that are all related, that all share the same root, and that help us to define the term subjection here. What I'd like you to do, first of all, is to look with me at the end of verse 1, and there's a word there. It says, those that exist have been instituted by God. The word translated instituted there, that's a fine translation, but it could be put in any number of ways. It's actually the Greek word tasso. Keep that sound in mind, tasso. It means to be arranged in this case. That is, God himself ordered or arranged or put in that place and in that position those authorities. That's the basic meaning of the word tasso, to order or to arrange. And I make that point because the word tasso is also in the word subject that we find at the beginning of verse 1, let every person be subject. Only in that case, the Greek word is hupotasso, and we find that actually the roots of these words communicate the concept pretty well. The preposition hupa, which is attached to tasso, means under. And that's where we get the idea that to subject yourself is to place yourself under, to arrange yourself under this structure. God orders the government. You order yourself underneath that authority. To put yourself under is the idea. And actually, the opposite of that would be mentioned here with another word in verse 2, where at the beginning it says, therefore, whoever resists the authorities. You know what that word is? That word is antitasso, which means to arrange yourself against, to put yourself in a position where you are not underneath the structure, but you are in conflict with it and you are opposing it. To subject yourself would mean to place yourself underneath. In fact, outside of the New Testament, that terminology is used for different ranks in the military. And in our context, we have generals and colonels and sergeants and corporals and privates and all sorts of other levels of authority. And each person knows their place, and there is a right sort of attitude and a right level of responsibility as well as a right level of submission depending on where in the hierarchy you fall. It would be inappropriate for a private to act like a colonel, or for that matter, for a general to act like a private. Each one has their role and their place in the structure, and each one needs to act in a way that is in keeping with the place that they have, putting yourself underneath those that have been placed above you. To posture yourself toward your authority in a way that is consistent with the place that you have. And it's also significant that this, actually pretty unusually, it's hard to communicate this well in English, it's a third person passive imperative. You're being given a command, but the command is passive. Usually a command is telling you to do something. Here it is commanding a person to let something be done to them. It's a passive imperative. That is to let yourself, as it were, be placed and be viewed in the light of this authority structure. And so our translations say, let every person be subject. Or you could just as well say, everybody should be subjected, should allow yourself to be led and governed by those over you. One other thought that I'd like to emphasize based on this and other usages of this word subject is that it's clear in this case the subjection is a voluntary matter. When, for example, Paul tells wives to submit themselves to their husbands, Ephesians 5:24, that's the same terminology that's used there. And it is not said that the wife or that the husband should bring his wife into subjection and sort of force her to do whatever he says. It's a decision that the wife makes that I will arrange myself under the leadership of this individual as far as our family is concerned. Or how about this example? This is just such a touching story about Jesus himself. When after the incident that he had stayed in the temple discussing the Bible, his parents finally find him and he goes back home with them, it says, he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. That's the word hupotasso. Now really, Jesus, the God-man, inherently was way superior to Joseph and Mary. And yet he knew that for this time of his life, it was appropriate for him to make the choice to place himself under these people, even though in this case he was actually way superior to them inherently. In the case of a husband and wife, we're dealing with equals before God and a voluntary choice to be subject. In the case of Jesus, you're talking about somebody who is over Joseph and Mary, who makes a choice voluntarily to be subjected to them and to abide in that place for that time. It is a voluntary choice that we're being called upon here to take. Now, what does that subjection look like? Normally, it does take the form of actual obedience to laws. It is fundamentally an attitude and a choice about how you view yourself and how you view the authority, but that's going to be tested and that's going to be demonstrated when actually the authority begins to lay down requirements. And submission is demonstrated by actual obedience to laws that are laid down. Normally, that's how it works. And our question is, are there any exceptions? Are there any exceptions? Does civil government possess absolute authority over us to where they are just kind of free reign to tell us whatever they want, and that whatever they say, without exception, we have to obey? Well, the Apostle Paul is teaching a general principle here. And it is not his purpose in this passage to provide a full-blown, nuanced Christian philosophy of government. And yet it is hard for us reading this, knowing what we know about our own lives, knowing whatever we know about history, knowing whatever we know about the Bible, to start thinking of questions and of challenging scenarios and even other things the Bible itself teaches. Are there any qualifications here? Are there any exceptions? Well, actually, I think even this passage implies qualification. For example, if you look down at verse 7, notice what it says there about the taxes. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, and so forth. The implication of putting it that way, give them what is owed to them, does leave open the possibility that they might ask you sometimes to give them something that actually you do not owe to them. And in fact, isn't that what is implied in the way Jesus answered questions about the government? And actually, Jesus' statements, like in Matthew 22:21, are probably the background for what Paul is saying in verse 7. Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. So that if Caesar asks you to do something or to get into something that is actually more directly under the authority of God, and there is a tension between these two authorities, Jesus actually does give you an out. It's really a very deft way that Jesus approached the question, assuming that God is the higher authority, and leaving open the possibility that if Caesar and God are directly in conflict as to the choices that are required of us, we ought to go with the higher authority. And the Bible helpfully gives you a number of examples along those lines. And let me just give them for you here quickly. You are in one of those situations when, for example, the government commands you to do what God forbids. Caesar and God are in a conflict when the government directly tells you to do something God forbids. Such as what? Such as the time when Pharaoh commanded the midwives to kill those Israelite babies, and they refused. Exodus 1:17. Such as when, in the book of Daniel, the three friends of Daniel are commanded to bow down before the idol, and they say, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. The government was telling them to do something God forbid, and they went with what God said. The opposite could be the case as well. When the government forbids you from doing what God positively commands, such as Daniel once again, who was forbidden to carry out his practice of prayer. And it says in chapter 6, verse 10, that when he knew the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks to before his God as he had done previously. The government said, don't pray. Daniel decided, I need to go with the higher authority. This is part of my responsibility to God. And in that case, he violated the command. And very clearly in the case of the disciples in the book of Acts, when they're told not to preach in the name of Christ, they say, chapter 5, verse 29, we must obey God rather than men in a case like that. So when the government commands you to do what God forbids, or when the government forbids you from doing what God commands, would there be any other exceptions? Well, we actually have another exception that is quite specific, but I think suggested for us. And it's from the book of Esther. And what's happening in that case is that the government is pursuing mass destruction of human life, and the people of God have ways that they can step in to stop that, but it would require actually disobeying the law. What was it that Esther did in going before the king to seek the overturning of the decree of Haman? What was it she had to do in order to seek the protection of her people, or to find some way to work that out and protect them? She actually had to disobey the law. Let me read it to you from her lips. She says to the people, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. Hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Esther chapter 4 and verse 16. We have precedent there. When the government is pursuing mass destruction of human life, that issue takes precedent over obedience to the law. And no doubt that was the thinking in modern times of people during the Second World War who risked their lives just like Esther did to do the very thing she did, and that was to protect Jewish people from the extermination by the Nazis. And so you can envision in a modern context that sometimes God's people will be faced with those kinds of tensions. The question is, given those precedents, should we broaden out these exceptions to include other extreme cases where the government is violating basic morality or actually promoting immorality? And is there any basis for sort of a revolutionary idea in the overthrow of governments in extreme kinds of situations? Well, at that point, it gets pretty complicated, because you have scripture that is very situational, some of which goes in one direction and some of which goes in another direction. Historically in the Bible, actually, God has raised up certain people to overthrow wicked governments and to bring his own judgment on them. And you can just think right through the Bible, almost from the beginning. God raised up Moses to bring judgment on the Egyptians. God raised up Joshua to conquer the people of Canaan and judge them, overthrow them. God would raise up from time to time within Israel judges who would overthrow these pagan governments that had them under subjection. It also worked the other way. Sometimes God used wicked people to overthrow the government of his own people when it was time for them to be judged. And so sometimes the Philistines were used to overthrow Jewish people and to judge them. Eventually, bigger forces like the Assyrians. And yet the time came when God used the Babylonians to overthrow the Assyrians. And eventually, the Persians were God's instruments to overthrow the Babylonians. And the cycle just kept going on and on. And when, for example, the people of God find themselves going through some of those periods where God says, "I'm using this group of people to overthrow your government and to judge you," how are they supposed to view all that? What is supposed to be their response? How do they relate to these foreign powers now? And at that point, when you start asking those kinds of questions, the situation starts going in a little bit different direction. Because you would think, well, God would eventually tell his people to, you know, fight the Babylonians and get out of here as fast as you can. Well, actually, in Jeremiah 29:7, he tells them to just stay there, build homes, and he says, "Get settled in, because it's going to be a while. Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare." So here they are commanded to be at peace with this wicked government and to actually do whatever they could to prosper the wicked nation that they were under. You understand the difficulty that they found themselves in. And by the way, that is precisely the position that Daniel found himself personally in. There were times when the will of God was in direct conflict with the will of the ruler, but those were exceptions, and for the most part, Daniel was actually working for the pagan government. And he was used by God to give success to these wicked people who were conquering the world and doing, in many cases, dastardly things in the process. And Daniel wasn't the first one to find himself in that position. You have, as well, people like Joseph early on helping the Egyptians. And then you have somebody that we have been considering in our Sunday school class, David, with reference to Saul and the extreme measures he took. For what purpose? Because he did not want to put his hand on the Lord's anointed, and he was waiting on God to take care of it instead of taking matters into his own hands to overthrow the wicked ruler in that case. You have other biblical examples, not the least of which is the Lord Jesus Christ himself, who subjected himself to wicked Jewish rulers and wicked Roman rulers, and here he is standing before Pilate with every resource at his disposal to deal with these people once and for all, and yet he yields himself to these authorities instead of fighting back. And this is why I say that it becomes a very difficult question to know biblically what to do reference to just generally wicked government who may not be telling you exactly you must do wrong, but nevertheless who are very actively promoting wrong things that would have an impact on your life. It may be sometimes God raises up people to overthrow that. It may be at other times that God just has his people stay there and suffer under that and actually seek the temporal prosperity of that nation. This is why you've had God's people really wrestle over this question and really come to different conclusions about it. How, for example, 40 or 50 years ago, should Christian Americans have responded to the civil rights movement? You had some Christian people who were very opposed to actually disobeying the law in order to seek racial equality. You had other people, Christian people, who on the basis of the Bible are actually arguing for disobedience to the law in peaceful ways and nevertheless to do whatever was in their power to do, even at the risk of being thrown in jail, in order to pursue something that was basically righteous and biblical. You understand why God's people did not agree on exactly how to deal with that problem. It's because the scriptures do not come down firmly and consistently on one side of the issue. It's a very situational matter as far as how God guided, even in Bible times. And these are the kinds of judgment calls, and these are the kinds of biblical, theological, and practical struggles that we are going to have to be discussing as Christian people in a society that is increasingly secular. One passage that I ran across that I thought was very instructive would be a passage like Proverbs 24, verses 21 and 22. This is from the NET Bible, which brings out very well the point. Fear the Lord, my child, as well as the king, and do not associate with rebels. For suddenly their destruction will overtake them, and who knows the ruinous judgment both the Lord and the king can bring. It says, fear the Lord and the king, and do not associate with rebels. In other words, there may come a time where you are up against a wall, and there's nothing to do scripturally but to resist. But in a case where we're not at that point, what the Bible, I think, encourages is caution. What the Bible encourages is wisdom. What the Bible encourages us is not to jump on a bandwagon of revolution and fomenting all kinds of dissent in society. And we're going to read some verses about that in just a moment. Now, in all of this detail about the exceptions and debates, it's very easy to lose sight, really, of what is the main point of this passage. What is the big picture or the primary duty that Paul is urging upon us here, and that most of the time is really not that controversial and really not that complicated? Most of the time. I like what Douglas Moo said. He says, "It is only a slight exaggeration to say that the history of the interpretation of Romans 13:1-7 is the history of attempts to avoid what seems to be its plain meaning." In other words, yes, maybe exceptions, but in discussions of this passage, it's like we're more concerned about the exceptions than we're concerned about really the point of the passage. The general principle is quite simple. Be subjected to civil government. Choose to arrange yourself under these ruling authorities. And then eventually the why question comes up. That's what subjection to authority means. Why do this? Why is it so important? And as I said, the passage is arguing for two reasons. Next week, we're going to move further into the passage, and we're going to deal with those two reasons. What I want to do today as we wrap up is not to look further into the passage, it's actually to look back. In other words, to fit this passage in its context. Remember what I said, that I was going to deal with two questions. First of all, what does it mean to be subjected to civil government? Secondly, what does subjection to civil government have to do with the gospel emphasis of the book of Romans? That question is answered by tying this to what came before, by looking at this passage in its context. And maybe as you have read Romans throughout your Christian life, you have wondered what I've wondered. I mean, I think we understand the Christian needs to relate properly to government. But when you look at Romans and everything that's been under discussion and what's been being emphasized here, it just seems like a random topic to bring up here out of nowhere. This has not been the point of this letter so far. And in a book that is so lofty, developing all these big ideas about God and man and sin and Christ and justification and sanctification and glorification, all of a sudden shift to something like government seems rather mundane. Like, what in the world does that have to do with this? What does this have to do with the gospel that we have been primarily talking about here? Well, that question is so troubling to liberal scholars that they do what they typically do when they don't understand a passage. They said, well, obviously this was added by some later editor because it disturbs the flow of thought. And that is ridiculous. There's no textual basis whatsoever to just lift this passage and throw it out as though somebody had dropped it in there. What is the connection with the context? What I want to do is kind of walk backward from this passage to some of the earlier teachings of Romans. And starting in chapter 12, and what we looked at the last time we were in Romans. Here is a connection. Back in chapter 12 and verse 19, Paul had told God's people, don't avenge yourselves, leave it to the wrath of God. Don't take matters into your own hands. Let God deal with it. Chapter 13 comes in partially to say, now, here is one of the ways that God deals with injustice. You don't need to take vengeance in your hands. God's going to take care of it. And sometimes he takes care of it by bringing vengeance through civil government that bears the sword, chapter 13 tells us. Well, that issue of no vengeance is actually part of a bigger idea where in verse 17, at the end, it says, give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. And one of the ways that you live an honorable lifestyle in a world that hates Christ is by representing Christ with the right attitude toward authorities that he's established. And here is a great sort of check on us whenever we're going to interact about the government, whenever we're going to represent our Christian values, is the way that I am doing this, is the manner in which I'm approaching this something that commends itself to the lost as honorable? Or do I look like a mean, vindictive, foaming at the mouth, obsessed sort of a person? Is this communicating something honorable? That's part of the application here. And that idea of honor is actually part of an even bigger subject, because you may remember that the heading for second half of chapter 12 is verse 9, let love be genuine. No vengeance, honorable love. Here is a dimension of love. A dimension of love is not to be anti-authoritarian. It is to recognize that God has placed structure there, and it is to show honor to people that the Lord has put in place. This is one of the ways that I demonstrate love. And the theme backs up even further to the beginning of chapter 12, when in verse 2 he says, do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Government is a part of this surrendered life, my response to government. It is a part, for example, of resisting the spirit of this age, of not letting this age shape me. How does this age, how do the people of the world think about authority? Anti-authoritarianism is not something restricted to the 21st century. This is just human nature to not like what people tell you to do, to not like it that people are over you in authority. The world is not particularly big on the idea of submission. They want to squeeze you into a rebellious sort of spirit. And Paul says, don't be shaped by that. Submission is actually a Christian value. And in fact, it may be that the Apostle Paul, specifically when he gets into the matter of taxes, is alluding to the fact that, according to the Roman historian Tacitus, around this time, there was actually a growing movement out in the world against certain kinds of taxes that were being imposed by Nero. And Paul is saying to them, don't jump on that bandwagon. And actually, the exhortation could go a little bit different direction. What are you to make of it when Paul says, look, you don't belong to this age, and Caesar's not really your king, Christ is your king? What are you to make of it when, in Philippians, for example, he says, our citizenship is in heaven, and we're all about the coming age, and the coming age has started now in our relationship to Christ as our king? Well, an overreaction would be to say, Caesar's not my king in any sense. And in a kind of a hyper-spiritual reaction, the conclusion could be, I don't belong to this realm. I have an otherworldly mindset. Jesus is my king, and I don't know Caesar anything. And Paul says, wait a minute. That is hyper-spiritual. That is not truly a godly way of thinking. Things are a little bit more complicated than that, because actually you live in this age and the age to come at the same time. And you are part of the city of God and of the city of man, and you have responsibilities to each. So this issue of civil government really does fit in to the unfolding theme of Romans. And finally, let's not forget that that appeal to live the surrendered life is in response to the mercies of God, verse 1. And it is one of the ways that we demonstrate that we have been humbled by grace. If salvation is by grace, if my righteous standing before God is purely a gift, I'm totally beholden to God. Actually, salvation by grace puts you in an even lower position of just being there before the Lord saying, God, what do you want me to do? Some people get this, and some people say, I don't want to be saved by grace because I know that if it's purely a gift, then that means God has total say over my life because I'm beholden to Him totally. And this is the connection. If you are properly humbled by grace, you say, God, my life is not my own. You've purchased me. it's all about Christ. What do you want me to do? And he says, well, partially I want you to submit to these authorities in your life. And it's with that in mind that I would argue that submission to the government is a gospel issue. It is not a gospel issue in the sense that it earns our salvation or that somehow we're contributing to our salvation by that submission. It is a gospel issue in that it is one way in which the outworking of a heart that's been humbled by grace moves, a spirit of submission. Not a spirit that is thrilled about revolution and upheaval and dissent. Not a spirit that is just all about defending my rights or even my constitution. Not a spirit that is known primarily for its political ideology. It is a spirit that says, Jesus Christ came to die for me, and my life belongs to him. And he calls upon me to yield myself to those in authority, even in cases when those people do not represent him well. Part of my response is to demonstrate the right subjectiveness. It's a spirit whose priorities and attitudes are shaped by the gospel and that wants to be known for that primarily, and that wants to do whatever is necessary for that message to get out. And when you look at the rest of the New Testament's teaching about the government, you find this all the way through. Why does Paul urge that we pray for those in authorities, in authority over us? 1 Timothy 2. That we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. And he goes on to say that through that we will be able to serve, and God, who has a heart of compassion for all peoples, that he would use us living this quiet and dignified life to reach those people. It is not so that you can have the American dream. It is so you can lead a quiet and peaceful life that appeals to people because you are so distinctive. He says in Titus chapter 3, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle and show perfect courtesy toward all people. There is a place for political involvement, and there is a place for, within our American democratic context, of participating to pursue those values that would be most pleasing to God. But here is another check to do that consistent with this principle. Right, wrapped into the teaching on government, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, to show perfect courtesy toward all people. Is that the spirit that characterizes a great deal of the conservative Christian movement politically in this country? That's a question we need to be considering. And Peter puts it this way, for this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. And again, that's in the context of talking about government. That by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. In other words, somehow by the grace of God, we need to find ways to deal with this whole realm so that people know us not only for what we are against, but for the positive good that we are for. For the positive impact that we are having on society because of our loving, kind, gracious, courteous, yielded attitudes, even toward those in authority as we deal with them. This is a gospel issue in the sense that it is an outworking of a heart that has been humbled by the grace of God. And may the Lord help us as we continue to look at this passage to be more and more yielded to his truth.